You're the last lecture going still.
No.
Do you want to come?
Today's here.
Oh, we're doing it here.
Oh, you're here. I am the lecturer.
You moved up in the world.
Yeah.
This map is on the same.
Top where you can get hot, cold, and regular.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Can you use that for peso?
Oh, the water system? Well, if you've only used it for water, you could, yeah.
That's all. And I figured if I just cover up the little plastic thing on the bottom, this is water, like kosher peso water. The best one was on the internet, kosher peso phone. Which is a new phone. Something has the numbers in it. Then this lady wrote, I buy a new computer,
keyboard?
Keyboard, because my kid eats over it. Well, you never heard of taking a vacuum cleaner? Are you going to eat it? I mean, people, they realize that somebody said, clean out your mind with the Lashon Hara and get rid of all that chametz. This is more chametz than the dust.
Yeah.
Hello. I have a very good friend that lives this way.
That's true.
Well,
Larry, of course. I have to get away.
Yeah, but I crack up. Oh, I say minimum twice a month. And I said, how would you want? And now it's like a billion and change. I don't know anyway. But a billion and change, and it's the one up. Well, you had a problem. Well, you went out there. I thought you had a big bag. So you gave me a
big
bag. I have another friend. I know that he was. The number six. Yeah. And there's the other thing. Because Jerry was on the board. And he was one of the most capable. And then he went to the board. And he got into the company. And he said, no, 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 no.
Good morning, everyone. I guess we're coming pretty close to the finish line, and I appreciate people coming out. So maybe gives you a little break from the Pesach cleaning. I wanted to talk a little bit about the mitzvah of the four cups of wine, Dalet Kaisas, which is a chiyuv d'rabbanan. We've been discussing the mitzvahs d'oraisa of the Seder, such as eating matzah, and the obligation to talk about the Exodus, Sefer Yetzias Mitzrayim, but there are a number of rabbinic commandments that we do as well, and one of the rabbinic commandments that augment the sense of freedom and liberation is the mitzvah of four cups of wine, and there are many different reasons that are given, but the most common reason that is already given by the Rishonim is that it corresponds to the four Lishonos of Geula. There are four terms of redemption that are in Parshas Vayera, when Hashem told Moshe Rabbeinu to go to Bnei Yisrael and tell them they will be redeemed. Vo'tzeisi, I will take them out. Vitzalti, I will save them. Vigaalti, I will redeem them. And the fourth one is Lakachti Eschem Li Liam, I will take them unto me for a nation. That is the fourth Lashon. And even though there is indeed a fifth term, Ve'vesi Eschem El Ha'aretz, I will bring them to the land. It is said that that refers to the messianic ingathering of the exiles that has not happened yet, and that is why we have Eliyahu's cup. It's very interesting that the reason we have Eliyahu's cup is the fifth cup, which is not drunk at the Seder, corresponds to the cup that we will drink when Mashiach comes, and Eliyahu HaNavi is the one who will announce the coming of the Mashiach. It is an Ashkenazic custom. It is not mentioned in the Gemara. The Gemara does mention one opinion, Rabbi Tarfon, who actually says you are supposed to drink five cups. And indeed, the Maral seems to have suggested that it's proper to drink five cups. And to this day, there are a few Hasidic groups that drink five cups. But the concept of having a fifth cup and not drinking it, that we call kosher elio, is an Ashkenazic minhag. Sfardim do not have that as part of their Mesorah, although many Sfardim in the course of the years have adopted that custom as well. But the connection to elio is that the fifth cup will be drunk when Mashiach comes, and as a result, elio Anovi announces Mashiach. Now, in the Maral, now again, let me just digress for a moment. You know, there is a very beautiful Haggadah that is called Haggadah Maral, the Haggadah of the Maral. Many of you might have it, you might use it. Now, there's some interesting bibliographical information about that. The Maral wrote a huge sefer on Yetzias Mitzrayim, all aspects of Yetzias Mitzrayim, in more than 70 chapters, and that is a sefer called Gevuros Hashem. And the Gevuros Hashem is all that the Maral had to say about Yetzias Mitzrayim. Now, if you look at the Haggadah of the Maral, which has two perushim, Divrei Nagidim, which is the Agadic portion, and Lashon Limudim, which is the Halachic portion, you will see more or less that it is taken, you know, 80% of it is taken from the Gevuros Hashem, and it's kind of an abridged Gevuros Hashem, but there's around 20% of new original material that does not appear in the Gevuros Hashem. As a result, one might think, so it's kedai to have the Maral's Haggadah, because I will get, you know, 20% stuff that does not appear in Gevuros Hashem. But what's interesting is there's a very, very serious bibliographical problem exactly whether the Maral's Haggadah is from the Maral. Basically, the Maral's Haggadah was not published until the early decades of the 1900s of the 20th century. It was published by a Rav Rosenberg, who was a Rav in Warsaw, and he claims to have discovered the old long-lost manuscripts in a German library, etc., and therefore he claimed this was the Ksav Yad of the Maharal. Many historians, including Talmidei Chachamim, have said that this was a forgery, and in fact Rav Rosenberg forged the Haggadah of the Maharal. Now, it's not a serious problem because, as I say, 80% of it is taken and lifted from the Gevuros Hashem, so the 80% that you'll be reading in the Haggadah of the Maral is from the Maral, 100%. But the 20% that isn't is said to be Rav Rosenberg's own chidushim, and not necessarily those of the Maral. Now still, the 20% is interesting, but it's lav dafka Maral. Again, Rav Rosenberg is a very, very interesting person. He was a big Talmud Chacham, he was a posek, but he did have a reputation for forgery, for patent. This is an interesting phenomenon. This is the reverse of plagiarism. Plagiarism is when I take somebody else's stuff and I publish it as my own. Rev. Rosenberg had an opposite problem. He would publish his stuff and ascribe it to somebody from an earlier generation, perhaps so people would accept it more. And by the way, it's not the only. We have some very outstanding examples of reverse plagiarism, if that's the correct word, in other Sfarim as well. And in fact, Rev. Rosenberg is even credited is a dubious term perhaps, with kind of inventing the famous story of the Maharal and the Golem. You know, everyone knows the Maharal made a Golem, and yet the problem is Maharal died in the 1500s, and no one ever heard of the Maharal making a Golem till the end of the 19th century, when again Rev. Rosenberg, you know, kind of found a long-lost manuscript that gave this whole story. So, the Haggadah of the Maral is an interesting issue, but be it as it may, one of the things that appears in both the Haggadah of the Maral and the Gevuros Hashem is very, very fascinating. The Maral has a whole different take on what the fifth kos is. In other words, the halacha is that, except for Rabbi Tarfon, we do not drink a fifth kos. But some people drink a fifth kos, the keneged vehevesi, but we don't. So most Mefarshim say we don't because hevesi refers to messianic redemption. And that hasn't been fulfilled yet. Maral is a whole different mahalach. Maral's mahalach is that vehevesi is not a lashon of geula because vehevesi refers to the parnasa, meaning to say, the first four lashonos are God taking us out of slavery and servitude. The fifth lashon, which is focusing on bringing us to Eretz Yisrael, the Maral said, that was fulfilled in the time of Yeshua ben Nun, but that is not a lashon of Geula, that is a parnasa. In other words, parnasa is how God gives you permanent sustenance once he's redeemed you from your travail. And therefore, Maral says, the kos hamishi is not a kos of geula, it is a kos of parnasa. Based on this, he has a very interesting recommendation. He recommends that as a heder mitzvah, the kos hamishi should be drunk, but only by the Baal HaBayis, that is the source of parnasa. Meaning the kos hamishi would not be drunk by everybody else unless they are supporters of their own family. Now, that might mean in the case of a kollel household, perhaps the woman will drink the kos hamishi. And in fact, he even has a very interesting arrangement.
Is this part of Gvurat Hashem or not?
I believe it is. I believe it is in the Gevurah Hashem itself.
Given what you said.
You're going to have to check it. We're going to have to check it. I checked it a few years ago. Now, the Maral then is another interesting adjustment. If you look at the Haggadah, you will notice, you know, we say part of Hallel before the meal, then we finish the rest of Hallel after the meal, but then after we finish Hallel, we then say the Kapitel, Hodu Lashem Ki Tov Kulam Chasto, right, what we say on Shabbos, which is 126. That's called Hallel Haggadah, the Great Hallel, although it's shorter than the regular Hallel. But it's great because it has the Pasuk, Nosein Lechem Lechol Basor, that God sustains us. And Parnasa is even greater than Geula, because Geula is flashy and miraculous, but Parnasa is the day-to-day. Now, Maral, and then we say Nishmas, and we finish Hallel. Maral basically says the following. He doesn't understand why we interject Hallel HaGadol there, because Nishmas is essentially considered to be the end of Hallel. Hallel HaGadol is a different thing. That's about Parnasa. Nosein Lechem Lechol Basar. So he recommends you finish Hallel, say Nishmas, make the bracha on the fourth cup, then the Baal HaBayis should say Hallel HaGadol, Nosein Lechem Lechol Basar, and then the Baal HaBayis would make a bracha on the fifth cup. He basically says that the interjection of Hallel HaGadol, where it is, doesn't really belong there, because Hallel is Geula, Hallel HaGadol is Keneged Parnasa. But again, as I say, it's a very, very logical reconstruction, but it's a fairly radical reconstruction. So our minhag is not to tamper with the Haggadah. In fact, what was the joke I just read? Somebody was making a joke. How many rabbis does it take to change a light bulb? And the answer is, rabbis don't change anything. You know, so we don't change the Haggadah, so to speak. But the Maral suggestion was very, very interesting. Okay, now putting that aside, I want to mention another interesting bibliographical issue. Around 2 years ago, someone asked me the following question. We know that one of the minhagim we have, it's a minhag, it's not a din, but it's a minhag that's hundreds of years old, all the way from the Maharil, who is the origin of Ashkenazic minhagim, in the 1300s, so it's a very, very old minhag, that when we recite the Ten Makos, we pour out drops of wine, either from the cup or with our finger, that itself is two different minhagim. And we also do it a little before when it says Dam V'yesh V'simrat Dashan, and we do it when we abbreviate the Makos, Tetzach Hadash Be'achav, so that's a total of 16 drippings, right? Dam Eish Timrot Dashan, that's 3, the 10 Makos is another 10, that's 13, and then the abbreviation, Tetzach Hadash Be'achav. Okay, now, if you ask everybody in the world that's ever been to a Seder, why do we do that? So the answer that everybody in the world always gives is that since the Makos referred to the affliction of the Egyptians, and the Egyptians suffered and the Egyptians died, so the same way by the splitting of the Red Sea, the Malachim wanted to sing praise to God, and Hashem said, no, Maisei Yadai, these are my creatures that are drowning, and therefore do not rejoice. So too, we want to show that our joy is reduced, diminished somewhat. And that's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful idea. Now again, Chazal did say that regarding the splitting of the Red Sea. But the application to this minhag of the drops of wine is not in Chazal specifically. Of course, the whole minhag is not in Chazal. All right, so somebody asked me, where is the makor of that? Who says, which commentary is the first commentary that applies this to the minhag of the wine, which is a minhag. Chazal didn't have that minhag even. So, the Haggadahs that give sources, like the Art Scroll Haggadah and the like, will tell you it's from the Abarbanel, who wrote a voluminous commentary on the Haggadah called Zevach Pesach. And some Haggadahs will credit the Avudraham. Okay, now the Abarbanel is voluminous, and although I have learned the Abarbanel, I cannot say I have learned it line by line, so I just assumed all of those years, if Art Scroll says it's in Abarbanel, it must be in the Abarbanel. In fact, that I didn't see it, there are things that you can overlook. But somebody told me, and I was quite impressed by the fact that the person was able to say this, says that he went through every line of the Abarbanel's commentary, which is very long, says, and it's not in the Abarbanel. Okay. So I figured, well, if it's not a Abarbanel, maybe it's Avudraham, and perhaps it was an Aleph Beis, and people got mixed up, printers got mixed up with the Abarbanel, Avudraham. Now, Avudraham is much shorter, so I went through that myself, and it's not in the Avudraham. So then I thought, well, maybe Rav Shimshon Ufal Hirsch, 19th century humanism and the like, So I went, looked at the Rav Hirsch Haggadah, not in Rav Hirsch. So this was getting to be a bit of a mystery. Where is this thought from? Where is this thought from? Because the reason the Maharil gives is totally different. He says you take your finger and you pour off the wine because etzpa elokim, because every makkah is the finger of God. And the Rishonim give a number of reasons, and none of these reasons refer to Rachmanut. And they even argue that the Rachmanut theme is not even so appropriate the first night, because the first night we say the whole Hallel. It's only the seventh night that we only say a half Hallel and the like. So I actually saw an article written in a very fine journal in Flatbush Chakira. It's online, you may have seen it, where somebody went to the tremendous amount of work to try to trace where this came up from. And he actually said that the first time in this was said as a written thought was a chiddush of a 19th century German Orthodox rabbi, not a reform, Rav Yirmiyahu Lau, in a Sefer of Drushas, which is totally obscure, called Divrei Yirmiyahu. And at the end of the Drushas, his grandson, who published the Sefer, said, I want to mention a few extra thoughts that I heard from my grandfather. And he said, my grandfather was Mechadesh, a new reason for the minhag of pouring out the wine. And he said a new reason, and this was based on having rachamim and not celebrating the downfall of your enemy. But that became, by far, really spread like wildfire. The author of this article showed that every single English translated Haggadah, every translation that gives any explanation of customs, gives this as the reason. Every single one. He traced all the way back and the like. So this is a very interesting point of how a relatively late machshava kind of conquered the Jewish world, and it pushed aside all of the earlier reasons. Again, I don't want to use the term politically correct, because it certainly represents an authentic value in Judaism. But this was not the makor of the minhag, as given by the Maharil and by the Rishonim. And the like. Now, so how did Art Scroll get Abarbanel and Avudraham? So so basically it was the following. So this author surmised that that in some editions of the Book of the Drushas, it said, the grandson of Rav Yirmiyahu Lau, his name was Binyamin Zeif. So he would preface his remarks with Aleph Beis, which just means Amar Binyamin. So the way it is printed is Aleph Beis Hatam She But then it says, Hatam sheshovchim et hayayin, and it says, Shamati mizikeni. So I don't know if they thought it was the Barbanel's grandfather, you know, whatever it is. So some surmised that later Malachtim, who look, you know, they take things from commentaries to put in their own Haggadahs, see, oh, Aleph Beis. Aleph Beis either means Abarbanel, or it means Avudraham. And different people went different ways. Now, unfortunately, once a mistake is made by one Malaket, it gets continued indefinitely, because what happens basically is, we're all guilty of this sometimes. We don't. If we see a word that is quoted in a sefer from another sefer, we don't always look up the original sefer. So consequently, once one malakeit attributed the word to Abarbanel, then all the other malakim, whether it's art scroll or whatever it is, oh, they see it there, you know, so they do it. So this was a mistake that just perpetuated, because somebody initially took the Aleph Beis at the end of the Sefer Divrei Yirmiyahu, and instead of Amar bin Yamin, which just means the grandson of the author of the Dreshos, it becomes Abarbanel or Avudraham. Yeah, so it's just very, very fascinating. Okay. Now, it's interesting that the Brisker Rav, Rav Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik, actually says an interesting thing. He says, as brisk Zerech normally is, that the mitzvah of Dalet Kosos has two different components to it. One is, there's a mitzvah to drink 4 cups of wine. Drinking is an expression of freedom, of liberation, of celebration. You've got to drink 4 cups of wine. But there's a second component, which is equally important, and that is, you are to perform a unique mitzvah on each kos. Amira al hakos. So on kos Rishon, you must recite Kiddush. On kos Sheni, you must recite Haggadah. Now, be sure you understand the implication of that. If the mitzvah would simply be to drink the cup of wine, then I can just fill up the cup before I drink. In other words, let's say, I make Kiddush, I drink the first cup. So let me just recite Haggadah, and then, after I finish, right before the meal, I fill up my wine, and I drink, right? Why do I have to fill up my wine all the way by the Manishtana, or Halach Ma'anya, depending? Let's say the Manishtana is the most common custom. So you might think, well, that's not necessary, I'll fill it up when it's time to drink it. Same thing with the fourth cup, right? Why can't I just fill up the fourth cup? No. It's extremely important that you follow the directions when you fill up the cup, because you are mechuyev to have an amira al hakos. So kos Rishon is Kiddush, kos Sheni is Haggadah, Magid, kos Shalishi is Birkas Hamazon, you bench over the kos, and kos revi is challah. Ad kidei kach, that many briskers, the brisker Rav himself, had the minhag, that they would hold the cup, just like you hold the cup for Kiddush, and you hold the cup for benching, right, that we always do, if we bench on a kos, you hold the cup for Haggadah, and you hold the cup for challah, because it's an amira al ha-kos. Now, this has, the brisker Rav said, a very, very interesting halachic application, and that is the following. Let's say that let's say that you were reciting the Haggadah on a kais, and then you put your kais down and it spilled. He says you cannot fulfill your mitzvah by pouring another cup and drinking it, because there was no amira on that kais. Rather, you have to refill the cup and say the Magid all over again, because you are mechuyev to have an amira al hakos and the like, right? Actually, this is the two dinim, as it were. The Brisker Rav said there's a mitzvah of shtia, and there's a mitzvah of amira to make every kos a kos shel bracha. But now let's focus on the underlying reason why we have 4 cups of wine. And the most common reason is, it is keneged the four Lashonos of Geula. Now, why are there four Lashonos of Geula? Yetzias Mitzrayim seems to be a single event. Why is there four Lashonos of Geula? So the truth is, the Netziv, in both the Mahamik Dovor and the Netziv's commentary of the Agada, the Netziv suggests that the Avdus Lecheiras was actually a gradual process that took place over the 10 Makos, meaning different Makis Medayit from the Psukim at different points. Paro released them to some degree, and he actually says there were four stages in their liberation. Stage one was Paro took off some of the most difficult work of Chomer Levanim, meaning he took off the most difficult work of making bricks. This is after he made it harder with the straw, but eventually he relented, but they were still Avadim. Stage two is they stopped being Avadim, but they were still inferior, they were still like discriminated against. Stage three, they became equal to Egyptians, but they weren't allowed to leave. Stage four, they were able to leave. So the Netziv basically correlates it to four levels of redemption. But I want to share with you a thought from the Meshech Chochma, Rav Meir Simcha Cohen of Divinsk, that I think actually has an application to contemporary society as well. He says that the reason why there are four Lashonot of Geula is because when one is a slave, and when a nation is an enslaved nation, there are four distinct dangers that they face. And because they face four distinct dangers, they need four redemptions. Danger number one is threat to their very physical survival. Brutal slavery can kind of kill you. It can kill your children. It can wipe you out. It can decimate you. Slavery can often be a form of genocide, and it often has been a form of genocide. And therefore, danger number one is danger to my physical survival. Danger number two is spiritual assimilation. Whatever your mission is, whatever your value system is, when you are subservient to a host culture that is antagonistic to your fundamental values, and you are a slave, over time, your spiritual core gets eroded and destroyed. Right? So that's the spiritual slavery. Danger number three, which may be a corollary, is lack of a sense of past. Now, those of you that might remember, was it in the 70s, I guess, the roots phenomenon, Alex Haley in the States, you know, produced the story of his ancestors and the like, and he brought out the point, in fact, the very name Roots highlights this, that one of the effects of people being taken into slavery is that they no longer have a sense of being connected to any past. It's as if they just came out of nowhere. They come from nothing, and therefore they are nothing. And therefore a slave often forgets his connection to the past. And as the story goes, if one does not know where they have come from, one cannot have a sense of where they need to go. So that is the third danger of a slave, losing his shaychus to the greatness of his past. And the fourth danger of slavery is lack of hope that the future can ever be better or ever be different. You make shalom with the matzav in whatever way it is. Now, this notion of hopelessness is very, very significant, even on the most biophysical way. You know, it is said that when a person is convinced they are going to die of an illness, the body itself begins to shut down, sometimes in an irreversible sequence of steps. Not because medically it had to happen that way, but because the person is in a state of hopelessness, believing things cannot be better. There's even anecdotal evidence, I don't want to call it scientifically proven, that people who believe in voodoo, right? If you believe that if somebody sticks a pin into an effigy of yourself, you're going to keel over, then people who believe in it keel over when they see it happening. Right? Mind over matter. It's, we might call it reverse placebo. you think this is going to hurt you, it hurts you. Just like placebo, you think it's going to help you, it winds up helping you to some degree. So these are the four dangers: physical annihilation, spiritual assimilation, lack of connection to the past, and lack of any hope that the future can be different. And God had to redeem us because of these four negatives that existed in our life. But here, Rav Meir Simcha says, in order for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to redeem us, there has to be, although we were not worthy, we're on the 49th level of Torah. 4/5 of the Jews, in fact, died. But the 1/5 was on the 49th level of impurity. But there needed to be some awakening on the part of the people. In the language of the Mekubalim, this is referred to as Isarusa Dilatata. Isarusa Dilatata is Aramaic, it just means an awakening from below. Dilatata, mitachat, in order to get the blessing from above. And Rav Meir Simcha identifies four behaviors the Jewish people had, each of which addressed in a little bit these four dangers and therefore merited the four redemptions. Now, the text that he uses is a little different than the text that most of us are more familiar with. You'll see what I mean in a minute. He uses a text from the Mechilta, which is a halachic medrash on Shmos. And the Mechilta says that the Jewish people had four merits which enabled them to be taken out of Mitzrayim. One is they didn't intermarry. The second is they did not speak Lashon Hara against each other. The third is they didn't change their names. They kept their Jewish names. And the fourth is they spoke Lashon HaKodesh. Now, the Gemara in Sota talks about they kept their clothing, etc. But let's go with this list because this is the list that he uses. They didn't intermarry. They didn't speak Lashon Hara. They kept their Jewish names. And they spoke Lashon HaKodesh. By the way, just as a little aside, these were the Jews that were at the 49th level of impurity, and they had these four merits, even though they were idol worshippers and the like, except for Shevet Levi. But if you think about how assimilated, I mean, you know, what percentage of the Jewish people, in fact, failed to have these four elements? Keep their name, speak Lashon HaKodesh. How many of us speak Lashon HaKodesh? I talk about myself. Not intermarrying, when the intermarriage rate in the United States is 50% or even higher in a lot of places. Right? So when people say, oh, those Jews in Egypt, they were so bad, you know, it's like we might be 49.5, you know, level as opposed to just 49.
The other 4/5 though did not do this.
The other 4/5 apparently did not. That's correct. This is talking about the fifth. Now listen to what the Meshech Chachma says. The Meshech Chachma very brilliantly will correlate each of these four behaviors to the particular danger. He says the following. Let's again, he'll switches the order a little bit. Let's first take physical annihilation, right? Dangers to the body. The great bulwark that protects the physical survivability of Am Yisrael is not speaking Lashon Hara. But here we have to understand what he means. Rav Meir Simcha says When we say they didn't speak Lashon Hara, we don't mean, I'm paraphrasing, that they learned Shmiras HaLashon and they followed the Chafetz Chaim and they were keeping the mitzvah of not speaking Lashon Hara. First of all, it was before Matan Torah. It is not referring to gossip. It is referring to a group solidarity that you don't give information to the authorities that could hurt your fellow Jew. That's what it means. They didn't speak Lashon Hara. They had a united front. The idea was that in times of stress, it is so tempting to try to curry favor. Rahman al-Islam, even in the Holocaust, superimposed on the awesome tragedy of the 6 million and more Jews that were murdered, is the fact that sometimes there were Jews who became informers or whatever the reason was. And again, I don't want to even sit in judgment because the pressures that people felt were unbelievable. Of course, in the long run, it tended not to help them. In the long run, they just folded back into the people who were killed as well. But people tried to do whatever they could for their children, for their spouses, even if that meant sometimes turning against a fellow Jew. In Mitzrayim, that didn't happen. And by the way, that didn't happen even among, that particular one didn't even happen among the four-fifths. Wow. United Front. Even Dasan v'Avira, who were hardly the most righteous of the Jewish people. These were the troublemakers. But they were the taskmasters who would get beaten by their Egyptian superiors because they would not inform which Jew didn't do his quota or whatever it is. So the Meshech Chachma says the not speaking Lashon Hara, which is exemplary of Avat Yisrael, solidarity, loyalty, not looking for what will help you if it'll be at the expense of another Jew, that protects us physically. Now we're going to say V'hishamdin la'agada V'hishamdin la'vaseinu v'lanu Shalom echad bilvad. It is not only one that has tried to destroy us, but in every generation there is enemies that try to destroy us. So the Sfas Emes retranslates ingeniously. Shalom echad bilvad does not mean it is not only one that tries to destroy us, but it is only the fact that we are not one. Shalom echad bilvad. Amad aleinu l'chaloseinu.
Yes, that is correct.
But I think here's the concept. Dasan v'Aviram were kind of socialists, and they resented Moshe because Moshe was a leader from the outside. It's interesting. They would not inform on their fellow, on the Jewish slaves. Moshe Rabbeinu, they identified him with the boss. That was their mistake. That was the chiluk. You know, there are surveys that the Israeli press runs every once in a while about what do people perceive as the most serious problems that the state of Israel faces. And, you know, unfortunately, we have a large, large amount of problems to choose from, whether it's Iran nuclear threat, whether it's Palestinian terrorism, Islamofascism, whether it's water, just, you know, an issue of cost of housing, cost of cottage cheese, whatever it is, all sorts of issues. But, you know, cell phones. The one thing that comes up always, over and over again, is the lack of achdus among Am Yisrael. And there's a sense, and this is true, whether the respondents are Chilonim and Charedim and Dati Yomi and Chardal, whichever group of respondents they have, people come up with this idea. And I've often quoted Benjamin Franklin, who said, I think it was at the either Declaration of Independence or the Constitution, probably Declaration of Independence makes more sense, he said to his fellow Americans who were breaking away from Great Britain, we must hang together, for if we do not hang together, we shall surely hang separately. And this is Lashon Hara, is the great, great Shemira, And this is not only in the frum sense. I mean, my sense, it's true in the religious sense as well. The Chavetz Chaim is many Mamari Chazal. But the Jewish people in Mitzrayim were not acting out of religiosity. But they were acting out of a deep sense. We are all in this together. And we're not going to turn around and look for our own advantages at the expense of a fellow Jew. So that was the Hisorus that allowed our lives to be preserved, our nation to be invulnerable. Now, what spiritual assimilation? So here, the truth of the matter is, spiritual assimilation was pretty bad. Most of the Jews were over the Avodah Zarah, except for Shevet Levi. Most of the Jews did not practice Bris Milah, except for Shevet Levi. But to whatever degree, a certain spirituality and refinement was preserved, it was because of the holiness of the Jewish home and the marital bond, not intermarrying, meaning faithfulness to a Jewish bias, to a bayit. And that is the source of Kedusha. It's been said, it's almost a cliche, that when a community, a new kahal is established in a city, the first thing it must have is a mikveh, even before a Beit Knesset, because Kedusha of Klal Yisrael comes in the relationship of husband and wife. And therefore, the antidote, or the shmirah, against total spiritual assimilation was the faithfulness of husband and wife, in which the wives gave their husbands a vision of emunah in Hashem and hope, and the husbands were faithful, except for one case, right? One case of Ish Mitzri, right? That's only one case. That's what Rashi says, that the Torah singles it out because there was no other case. Now, So therefore what? Therefore, the not speaking Lashon Hara protects us physically. The faithfulness of husband and wife in building a home of two Jewish people is something that preserves a spiritual surah of one sort or another. Now, he then says that what about the lack of connection to the past? So here he says, Lo shinu et shemam. They didn't change their names. Now we know, now this is a bit of an anachronistic word because it's Lav Zavka the way things were done then, but he's giving us a homiletic message at least, that generally speaking, we name people after our ancestors of the past. Whether it's an immediate ancestor like a grandfather or a grandmother, an aunt or an uncle, or whether it's our old ancestors, you know, Avraham Avinu, Moshe Rabbeinu. And what does that tell a child? That tells a child, you don't come from nothing. You have a history. You have a connection. You have a legacy that you're building upon. You have a Moshe and a Shlomo and a David. And even a Ger who doesn't have the biological connection. But if anything, the connection is even deeper. You are a spiritual child of Avraham and Sarah because you embrace what they stood for, you embrace what they lived for. And therefore, Meir Simcha says the importance of a Jewish name is that it connects a person to the past. Now, that's an interesting commentary, you know, because we do know, particularly in the state of Israel, but in America too, people sometimes invent names, and you know the names might be very nice, but they're not names of ancestors or anything. They're just new names. Now, Rav Chaim Kanevsky, as a matter of fact, happens to be very, very much against it, because he has a shita that names have to be found in Chazal or Tanakh. Although I hate to be cynical, as far as I know, the name Chaim does not appear in Chazal or Tanakh. But okay, maybe the Stadler didn't agree with his son on this. But okay, but be it as it may, how do you deal with new names is an interesting question, but derech klal, names are things that connect it to the past. And by the way, even Yiddish diminutives are so significant, you know. When we call a little boy or girl, you know, bubula, mamala, tatala, think about what that means. You know, I mean, we use it interchangeably. We don't necessarily think about it, but Bubbala means little bubby. Tatala, little father, little mother. You name somebody after your mother, after your father. As kibud aviyev, you actually don't want to refer to a child by the name of your parents. So you call them little mother, little father. So on one hand, the child sees how much reverence, how much kavod one has for an ancestor. And on the other hand, the child understands that he's continuing something. And therefore, when a person is a slave, he always had a sense of the roots of being connected to Avraham, Yitzhak, Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. And then, finally, the final problem was lack of hope, hopelessness. So here, Rav Meir Simcha says, speaking Lashon HaKodesh, in the Golah of Mitzrayim, in the Avdus of Mitzrayim, is such an explicit statement, we're not going to be here forever. You know, Latin was the language of the Roman Empire, and today it is not even the official language of the Roman Catholic Church. Some fanatic Catholics, some really ultra-Orthodox Catholics, you know, still do the old Catholic Mass. But the Pope doesn't require that. I mean, they're more machmir than the Pope. Right? The official position of the Catholic Church is that the Mass can be recited b'chol lashon. Right? B'chol over the Mass b'chol lashon. And as a result, now it used to be, that Latin was actually required for professional degrees. Lawyers, doctors had to know Latin, etc. And in fact, in colonial times in the United States, to graduate a university, you need to be conversant with classical Greek, Latin, and Hebrew. Yale University's motto is Urim V'Tumim, and even Harvard itself, until around maybe 50 years ago, there had to be an oration in Hebrew. One of the speeches at graduation had to be in Hebrew. They gave it up. Even though the Maisa, they could actually probably find more people who speak Hebrew in Harvard now than 50 years ago when they had quotas on Jews. But they don't require it as part of the ceremony, probably because a lot of the audience would not understand it. In fact, just as an aside, there is a legend I heard. It might be a legend. I don't know. I have no idea if it's true. I heard it when I was a kid, and I've seen it in some of these, Guinness Book of World Record type books, that at the time of the American Revolution, the hostility towards Great Britain, towards England, was so severe that there was actually a movement that English should not be the language of the United States, and they were considering some alternatives. And Hebrew was an alternative that was considered. This is before Eliezer ben Yehuda. And legend has it, again, it sounds like too good of a story, that it was defeated in the Continental Congress by one vote. So had there been one vote, Hebrew would have been left. Now, le'idach kisa, there was actually some opposition within the Zionist movement that Hebrew should be the language. You know, nobody knew Hebrew. And of course, as Eliezer ben Yehuda demonstrated, Hebrew did not have that many words that which for modern phenomena and the like. That's why I have to make up things whatever it is, and the like. So there was some proposal from the Technion fellows and the like that either German or English should be the national language of the State of Israel. So imagine how history would have come out. I teach many Chozrei B'Tshuva in Or Sameach, and they're always having to break their teeth over learning Hebrew. Imagine, they came from America where everybody spoke Hebrew, but they're breaking their teeth trying to learn English. They can't order a falafel in English. But it would have made the learning of Torah much easier. That would have been an interesting thing. But be it as it may, there is no movement to teach Latin on a broad public scale today. And the reason is, because although people look at languages for intellectual reasons, But people do not learn languages on a broad scale unless there's a realistic belief that they're going to use it in their culture. And since the Roman Empire is not coming back, and even in Italy, Latin is not the language they're speaking, we don't learn Latin. So, if I'm a slave in Egypt, and I've been here, my parents have been here, my grandparents, my great-grandparents, and Egypt is the most powerful empire in the world, and no slave ever escaped, and this is our permanent state, this is who we are and what we will always be, then why am I learning Hebrew again? So what is a parent telling his child when he's teaching him Lashon HaKodesh? We are not here forever. There's going to be a time we're going to leave. It may not be in my lifetime and it may not be in your lifetime. But there's going to be a time we will come to our land. We will have our language. And therefore, we are preparing even now for the time that Hashem is going to liberate us and keep the promise that he made to Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. So now we see, once again, not speaking Lashon Hara protects us physically. The sanctity of marriage protects us spiritually. The not changing of our names connects us to the past. And our preservation of Lashon HaKodesh is hope for the future. Four dangers required four redemptions. But those redemptions could come only if there were behaviors on our part that at least addressed those dangers to create a hisorus militata from below. So there's a greater geula from above. Now the final piece of the puzzle is that he connects these four dangers and four behaviors to the actual place where the four cups appear in the Seder. The first cup, the first kos, is of course the kos of Kiddush. By the way, this year, because it is also the Kiddush of Friday night, so this kos might actually be a doraisa. We're actually stricter. This kos is more chamor than any of the other cups and any of the other, even the first cup, the rest of the year. Now, Kiddush, we know, is associated with a bias. Now, ain't Kiddush el makom sudah. You make Kiddush where your meal is. Chazal say, kol ha-poresh min ha-erva. When you're faithful to your spouse and you don't go to arayas, that's called Kedusha. And of course, marriage itself is the word Kedushin, sanctification. So the first kos, which is on Kiddush, celebrates the family and the union of husband and wife as the basis for holiness and the prevention of spiritual assimilation. Now the second kos is Haggadah. Now Haggadah is the story of our past. Again, it's out of order, but you know, but the order doesn't have to be followed that way. Meaning, it can. What is the Maggid? But connecting the future generations, the new generations, with the past of Am Yisrael. Knowing that there was an Avram, a Yitzchak, and Yaakov, that Hashem made promises to them, that Hashem redeemed our forefathers. You don't come from nothing. You come from this glorious heritage. So that deals with counteracting the sense that a slave has no past. Now, Birkat HaMazon, this is a little more subtle, but what is Birkat HaMazon? Birkat HaMazon is Hakaras HaTov. Now, when you're grateful to Hashem for what He gives you, you don't have jealousy over what other people have, because you are Sameach B'Chelko. When you are Sameach B'Chelko and you don't have jealousy, that creates Achdus, love, togetherness, which in turn diminishes lashon hara. So therefore, birkat hamazon is the physical survival mechanism. We then finally come to Hallel. Now, as I mentioned last week, the Hallel of Leil Seder is very unique because it is divided. Some of it is before the meal, and some of it is after the meal. Most of it is after the meal. The Rishonim already say that the two kapitlach, the two chapters that we read before the meal, are praising Hashem for Yitzias Mitzrayim. Hallelu Avdei Hashem, V'lo Avdei Paro, the Gemara has a drasha. The second chapter is B'tseis Yisrael Mi Mitzrayim. But the Hallel after the meal is very sublime. We are actually graduating. We're no longer focused on Yitzias Mitzrayim. We are focused on the Geula HaAsita, the future redemption. That is why we open up the door. That is why we welcome Eliyahu Hanavi. And that's why there is indeed among Gedolim, and perhaps you may have even experienced it yourself, there's a certain ecstatic nature to the Hallel after the Seder. Again, if some people were falling asleep, that's true. But there's something in which you go to a different place. You're no longer thinking about the past, but you're focusing on the redemption of the future. And that is the idea of hope and faith. So therefore, we have this beautiful pattern of four dangers, four redemptions, four behaviors, and the commemoration of those four behaviors in the placing of the four cups throughout the Seder. Okay, so this is something that we should think about. And once again, the idea that the Hallel after the meal is the Hallel of Geula, the Hallel not of... In fact, this is why it says, in the Maggid itself, this is very, very interesting. When we finish the Maggid, and we're going to say, before the meal, we're going to say the two chapters of Hallel, and we say the two chapters, and then we say a bracha on the second cup, besides the Beit Hagafen, and we say the bracha of Asher Ga'alanu, blessed art you Hashem, Asher Ga'alanu, V'Ga'alas Avoseinim and Mitzrayim. So it says, V'Nodeh Lecha, and we will give thanks to you, Shir Chadash. Now, if you have a good grammatical memory, before we started the Hallel, right? Before we started the Hallel, we said "V'nomar lefanav shira chadasha." Now I know in Katamon you have shir chadash and shira chadasha, but there are actually reasons for that differentiation. But that would not be the reasons of the Haggadah. So the question is, how come I go, now again, grammatically you can go either way. Shir can take masculine or feminine. But why, before the Hallel is Shira Chadasha, but in the Birchas HaGeula it's Shir Chadash? So Tosfos in Arvei Pesachim brings a very, very beautiful explanation. He says that Shira, it's an expression of redemption. It's the joyous song of redemption. But he says, all of the geulos that we have in Olam Hazeh are like the birth of a child. There is pain. There is travail. There is labor. And that is why the Shira is Belosha Nekeva, because there is a tsar both before the birth and after the birth. So, since the first two chapters of Hallel are about Yitzias Mitzrayim, and in Yitzias Mitzrayim, number one, there was tremendous suffering before the Geula, the slavery, and number two, after the Geula, just as a woman after childbirth can have postpartum depression or even physical pain, So too, in the Midbar, you know, many, many Jews died. There were punishments in the Midbar and the like. So, Yitzias Mitzrayim, the Hallel is called Shirah Chadasha. But, in the Birchas HaGeula, we already said, just as you redeemed us, so may you will redeem us. And when you will redeem us, we will have Shir Chadash, like a Zohar. A Zohar that has a kid, no pain, right? Man gets by for free, right? So all of the Shiros in Olam Hazeh are Belosho Nekeva, because there is pain and suffering in the process. But the Shir of Mashiach will be a Shir of a Zohar. Now, one has to understand that this is not such a simple idea, because after all, Chazal describe in great detail, as well as the Nevi'im describe in great detail, what we call Chavle Mashiach, the birth pains of Mashiach, and the suffering, and the wars of Gog Umagog. So to say that the Messianic redemption will be without suffering, L'chore, is not true. But I think what he means is that after the redemption there will be no suffering, meaning the pains of childbirth remain even after childbirth. That will not happen with Mashiach. With Mashiach, there will be the end of all of that suffering. And that highlights the idea, therefore, that the first two chapters are Shira Chadasha, because they are Keneged Golus Mitzrayim, but the future Geula is called a Shir Chadash. So, B'nai Zemei, wish you all a Chag Kasher V'Sameach, may be a true Pesach of Geula for all of us, for all of Klal Yisrael, for all of the world.